The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. America, America, my country tis of who exactly? Don't tread on me, say the Bundy brothers, who took the law into their own hands and led an armed takeover of an Oregon wildlife refuge earlier this year. What does the court say?
Ammon Bundy is
not guilty!
Ryan Bundy is
not guilty!
What about David Frye?
Not guilty!
That's right, the Bundy brothers were acquitted last night along with 5 other anti-government protesters who had been charged with federal conspiracy and weapons charges after they occupied the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge for 41 very cold days over January and February. But if you say, don't tread on me, and are instead part of a tribal protest against the building of a pipeline on treaty-recognized sacred land in North Dakota, and by the way, are unarmed, it's the paddy wagon for you.
You have to get off the pickup and move to the south.
Only in America, the Bundy acquittals came the same day police arrested 117 people protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. All of this with the rigged election conspiracy theory anti-government backdrop of the 2016 presidential campaign. A rich brew, to be sure. Amelia Templeton is a reporter with Oregon Public Broadcasting who's been covering the Bundy trial. Amelia, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much.
Pretty dramatic in that courtroom. Why don't you give us a sense?
Well, the very first name that was read off of the verdict sheet was Ammon Bundy's name. And I think as soon as we heard not guilty for Ammon Bundy, it was pretty clear that nobody in the case was going to be found guilty. And there was kind of stunned silence. And then shortly after, an even more stunning development, which was that attorney Marcus Mumford, who represents Ammon Bundy, insisted that his client was free to go and free to leave. Bundy, of course, is facing charges in Nevada for the standoff on his family's ranch in Bunkerville there, and there's a U.S. Marshal hold to transfer him to that state to custody there. But Mumford insisted that was not the case, started essentially yelling at the judge, and when she ordered him to stop yelling at her, U.S. Marshals moved in, they surrounded him, he resisted arrest, they forced him to the ground, and we were all told to leave the court as they were yelling, stop resisting, you are going to be tased.
They grabbed all the U.S. Marshals, attacked Mumford, and throws him to the ground, there was like 8 of them on him, and they tased him. The attorney, it's unreal. How can they do that? This is not justice. This is a mob. It's a mob rule. And we've got to stop that kind of stuff happening in America. You guys, this is unreal. I can't believe it.
That's defendant Shauna Cox speaking to reporters outside the courtroom after you all were cleared from that courtroom, Amelia. I suspect you heard those words as well. I mean, if the feds were trying to avoid exactly this kind of scene, they really blew it.
Yeah, this was a stunning, stunning victory for the defense and really for the Patriot movement and this political cause. I think when it comes to that confrontation with attorney Marcus Mumford, my sense is that, you know, throughout this case, he has been trying to protest the legal system itself, and that was really his sort of attempt to continue that. And it's interesting because Ammon Bundy became famous in part because he was tased at Bunkerville and there was a video of it online. So it almost seems a sort of parallel to that and a continued effort to build not just their legal case, but their political movement.
A cynic would say they're looking for a photo op.
Sure, or that they're very aware of the power of what they do and the spotlight that's on them.
What was the context of these acquittals? I mean, is this a judge, a jury? How did this go down?
It was a jury. The jury had to reach a unanimous verdict. They did that for all 7 defendants. But there was a little bit of drama with the jury because the jury had been deliberating for almost exactly a week. And a few days ago, they said that they were essentially deadlocked, that they were having trouble reaching agreement on some charges for some defendants. And at the same time, one juror accused another juror in a note of being biased. And it was a very confusing and delicate situation. And eventually the judge decided that she had to remove that juror, that there was no way to sort of fully investigate that claim without sort of tainting the jury process. And so they removed that juror and replaced him with another. And within not very many hours of deliberation after they made that change, the newly convened jury came up with a stunning verdict.
Is it an overstatement to suggest that in Eastern Oregon, it would be hard to find 12 people who wouldn't be inclined to acquit the Bundys in charges like this, that there was a certain amount of sympathy for them, even if the rally didn't attract a huge movement?
I don't think that this verdict was necessarily about sympathy for the Bundys. So the jury was drawn from across the state of Oregon, broadly across all parts of the state, not just Eastern Oregon. The trial took place here in Portland in federal court. And I think if you look at what they were actually charged with, they were facing a charge of conspiracy to impede federal workers from doing their job. And I think that charge created some real challenges for the prosecution, and it gave some openings to the defense to essentially say, hey, wait a second, they weren't trying to impede federal workers. Sure, they occupied this refuge, but their goal was to make a political statement, and they didn't threaten anyone directly. And I think the government may not have done a good enough job of showing that workers did, in fact, feel threatened.
And another confrontation with federal authorities taking place out in North Dakota. It's a Wild West, wouldn't you say?
Well, it's certainly a time of great turmoil. And I think one thing we heard on the steps of the courthouse after this was people in this movement essentially saying, we're not going anywhere. On to the next protest, on to the next cause. Let's pick back up the case of the Hammonds, these ranchers that we think were unfairly resentenced for arson. So I think this verdict may give a lot of different groups a lot of confidence in taking their grievances to federal land and showing up and being very visible and potentially very visibly armed.
Great stuff. Amelia Templeton is a reporter with Oregon Public Broadcasting, been covering the Bundy trial. Amelia, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Moving along on this Friday, if Hillary Clinton is locked in an epic campaign for the White House right now, the latest WikiLeaks documents from the hack that penetrated the private email account of Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta's private emails at least shows Bill Clinton having a darn good time in his post-presidency. His Clinton Foundation appears to be a money machine, with Doug Band, a top aide to Bill Clinton, working the power elites for millions in cash. And what's all the cash for? Annie Carney is politics reporter for Politico. Annie, this is very Clintonian stuff here, right?
It is. And also, again, in the fact that it's murky and it looks bad and it's about making a lot of money, but there's not still no smoking gun quid pro quo, you donate to the foundation, you get access kind of issue. She's likely going to win this election. But this is a reminder that all of the baggage that comes with her is going to come flooding back on November 9th. We're going to all remember that she has like high unfavorability ratings of anyone aside from Donald Trump, that she is going to be dogged by Congress is going to investigate anything they can about her. I mean, but they have, in their defense, they've already kind of dismantled the Clinton Foundation as much as they can in preparation of her going into the White House.
They've done a little bit of defense already in the fact that they got this a two-year-old stamp of approval of the Clinton Foundation, that it basically meets the sort of smell test of the tactics that it's using and the way that money is used. Mm-hmm. But still, what this WikiLeaks window gives us is a sense of just how ruthless Bill Clinton seems to be.
I don't know about that. Yes. It's like, it's almost like how Bill Clinton is at that other people are deciding what he does. Chelsea Clinton's argument is Doug Band is leading my father down a dark path, a murky path that will get us all in trouble. And Doug Band's argument, it seems like, is I'm not doing anything he doesn't want me to be doing for him. But this is the problem with Bill Clinton, that, you know, he needs to be steered by someone who's not going to take him down a path that gets him in trouble.
Remembering the whole Monica Lewinsky business, mm-hmm, and the impeachment, I mean, don't you think, I mean, maybe I'm a cynic, don't you think Bill Clinton writes no memos, puts nothing down
on paper?
Yeah,
he doesn't use email.
Yeah, he's, yeah. I mean, Bill Clinton is like not going to ever, ever appear in any sort of print.
He does not use email, right. Which so, after this hack we've learned is probably pretty smart.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Clinton, whatever his approach to the Clinton Foundation is, you're not going to see a smoking gun from him ever.
Correct.
But is the WikiLeaks, you know, body of work here an argument for what are these foundations? What is this all about here?
Well, this is, I think more than anything, it's an argument of why you don't set up an international foundation that takes donations from foreign governments and banks when you're not finished serving in government. If Hillary Clinton was not running for president, if this was really their post public service life, I don't think that anyone would really care. It's the conflict is because she's not finished. This is the kind of foundation you set up when you are not going back into the government.
So final verdict is it's not going to derail Hillary at this point, but it is definitely something that we're going to be looking at for a long time.
Their line, the campaign's line, is that this isn't what voters are thinking about. Voters are thinking about economic issues and who's going to be a champion for the middle class. And Trump has been just proven to be she's made the case that he's unfit to serve for office and that there's 11 days to go and she will win. But we're ending the campaign, instead of ending it on a high note of making Americans feel like they're voting for something, not just against Trump. This is not really what they want the closing argument to be about.
Well, the suddenly famous Doug Band is not available for comment, apparently. But Teneo, the public relations firm that is all over these memos, seems to suggest that they are authentic, they haven't been tampered with, and that they will, you know, soon to appear in a congressional hearing.
The Clinton campaign's line on all the emails is they're not authenticating any of them. They are scared that there has been nothing that will completely derail Hillary. Maybe that there'll be something awful slipped in there, like a fake made-up email. Mm-hmm. But so far, no one has disputed the veracity of any of them. Reporters who are showing up in there recognize their own emails. So it does. So far, everything that's out seems to be real.
Annie Carney is politics reporter for Politico. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So it's a U.S. Senate race that gives us the latest chapter in the 2016 story of America, that welcoming land for immigrants. Last night in Illinois, during a debate between Democrat Tammy Duckworth, who is challenging Senator Mark Kirk, a Republican, listen for this sprint down the low road.
My family has served this nation in uniform, going back to the Revolution. I'm a daughter of the American Revolution. I've bled for this nation. But I still want to be there in the Senate when the drums of war sound, because people are quick to sound the drums of war. And I want to be there to say, this is what it costs. This is what you're asking us to do. And if that's the case, I'll go. Families like mine are the ones that bleed first. But let's make sure the American people understand what we are engaging in. And let's hold our allies accountable, because we can't do it all.
Senator Kirk, 30 seconds to rebut.
I had forgotten that your parents came all the way from Thailand to serve George Washington.
Ooh, Duckworth's mother is of Chinese descent but was born in Thailand. Her father, Frank Duckworth, was a U.S. Marine veteran who traced his family's heritage to the Revolutionary War. Meanwhile, in Indiana, former Senator Democrat Evan Bayh and Republican Congressman Todd Young are running to replace the retiring Republican Senator Dan Coats. It's a really close race for Bayh, who was also the state's governor from 1989 to 1997. Brandon Smith is the State House Bureau Chief for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Tony Arnold is the state politics reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. Tony, Brandon, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having
me.
It's
good to be here.
So, Brandon, give us a state of play in Indiana first.
Sure. Evan Bayh is locked, like you said, in a pretty close race with Republican Todd Young, which comes as somewhat of a surprise. When Evan Bayh joined this race in July, about halfway through the campaign cycle, early polling, though admittedly partisan polling, had him up 26 points. That lead dwindled down to almost nothing before he's sort of rebounded a little bit in the last couple of weeks. But that lead is still just outside the margin of error.
And what does that relate to? I mean, you've got Pence as the vice presidential candidate, but you also have Trump seeming to tank in polls, but not so in Indiana?
Not quite. The Trump's lead here has certainly narrowed, but he still has a lead, and I would say it's roughly comfortable. What it's really accounting for is Todd Young early and often went on the attack against Evan Bayh, and there seems to be plenty to attack. He attacked issues of Bayh's residency. Bayh has a couple of different homes outside of Indiana, in Georgetown and in Florida. He attacked issues of Evan Bayh's vote for the Affordable Care Act, for Obamacare, which is largely unpopular here in Indiana, despite how many people here use it. He's attacked issues of Bayh's time at the end of his time in the Senate in 2010, when he was apparently or seemed to be looking for a post-Senate job, and that may have affected his votes in the Senate. So there's been plenty to attack, and I think that has significantly helped drive down the polls for Evan Bayh.
Hold on there. That's Brandon Smith, State House Bureau Chief for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Tony Arnold, State Politics Reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. What was Republican Senator Mark Kirk thinking when he suggested that his challenger's parents came from Thailand to serve George Washington?
What was he thinking? I think that when he made the comment, there were a lot of people in the room kind of scratching their heads, trying to figure out what that meant. There wasn't an immediate reaction. And so, you know, Kirk has he's made several comments now over the last few years that have gotten him into trouble. Those have been referred to as gaffes. This one is not being referred to as a gaffe. It's taken as something much more serious, and Democrats have called this comment from last night that you heard at the top racist and offensive. And I think it's worth noting here that some of this that's come out is Mark Kirk had a stroke in 2012, and a lot of these comments have come since the stroke, which have raised questions over to his capability to do this job. Most recently, in the Chicago Tribune, the editorial board and its endorsement of Tammy Duckworth said that Kirk is simply he's not fit, he's not able to do the duties of a U.S. senator. And so there's been all sorts of questions about what the stroke has done to Kirk's mind, and he's been very vocal in that he is still qualified to do this job. It's actually made him a more empathetic person, which makes him he argues a more qualified person to be a senator now.
Well, we wouldn't want to certify that the Chicago Tribune's editorial board has any medical expertise per se, but given that, how is this race gone down? Is it very, very close? Is it Duckworth's to lose? What's happening in the last days?
Duckworth has had a lead in the polls that has shown. So this is one of those that Democrats, national Democrats, have seen as one that is very capable and likely to flip. Kirk's own polling has shown him much closer, but with the top of the ticket right now, and a lot of Illinois is heavily leaning toward Clinton, I think that Kirk's work has always been cut out for him. Kirk has done a lot to distance himself from Donald Trump, even running TV ads where he speaks in Spanish and he criticizes Trump. And that feud is ongoing. Last night, Trump's own campaign spokeswoman, Kellyanne Conway, tweeted out the comments that Kirk made during this debate. And she said in her tweet, "The same Mark Kirk that unendorsed his party's presidential nominee and called him out in paid ads? Gotcha. Good luck." So there's no love lost here between the Trump campaign and the Kirk campaign. But I don't think that Kirk's own comments against Trump have necessarily gotten him a lot more further in the polls to get him over the hump to be able to beat Duckworth at this point.
So a struggle for Kirk in Illinois. Thanks, Tony Arnold. Brandon Smith, State House Bureau Chief for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Is there a Hillary Clinton number that suggests there would be a flip in Indiana?
No, there isn't. As much as, like I said, the lead for Donald Trump here has diminished over the last few weeks, as obviously all of the turmoil at the presidential level has gone on, Hillary Clinton has still struggled to get to that 40% mark. So while Donald Trump's win in Indiana may not be very big, which could help down-ticket Democrats a little bit, it certainly nobody here expects him to lose.
But is there a number that would help Evan Bayh win?
Not necessarily. This state is known for splitting its ticket, and there's a certain extent to which Evan Bayh's success will likely be independent of Hillary Clinton's here.
All right. Independence is the story for both states. Brandon Smith and Tony Arnold, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Brandon Smith, State House Bureau Chief for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We also heard from Tony Arnold, state politics reporter for WBEZ in Chicago, home of the Cubs.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
In genteel public radio, where else can you find a place that on the Friday before Halloween will tell you how to enrich your scary movie diet with progressive feminism? A consumer's guide to avoiding the so very patriarchy-generated chainsawed screaming girl scenes. All those torture sessions. We want movies where girls fight back rather than accept their timid Mia Farrow's satanic Rosemary's Baby fate. The Takeaway, of course, is here to help. With culture reporter Melissa Locker's certified list of feminist horror films, starting with The Babadook.
Yeah, it's this poor single mother struggling with, I think it's a kind of a metaphor for like depression or grief, and this, you know, evil thing like infiltrates the entire house, and then the woman has nothing to do but protect her child. And I mean, this is my total nightmare, and it is so scary and so good, and honestly, I really think we should have more female directors making horror movies because they get something that has never really been seen on screen before.
It's untried territory, and you know, it definitely gets you away from the chainsaws.
Yeah, and she's Australian, and I have to say, Australian horror movies are some of the scariest out there. It is a whole subgenre that is a different conversation, but if you want to really terrify yourself this Halloween, the Australian horror movie is a genre for you.
What else have you got?
Teeth is, it's about a young girl who develops teeth in a very unlikely location.
So
bad. When someone tries to force himself on her, things do not go as he planned. And
ouch.
At first, you know, she's horrified by this development, but then she soon comes to embrace it as a, you know, wonderful gift.
What about the most precious gift of all? Are you going to give that to the first guy who buys you a big bunch of roses?
No way.
Have you seen Jennifer's Body?
No.
It stars Megan Fox as a virgin sacrifice gone very, very wrong.
Puncture wound. God, that's so emo. I need you frightened. I need you hopeless.
And she turns into basically a man-eating demon who tracks down all the various men, lookout high school football captains, and turns them into, you know, her main course.
Okay.
Have you seen It Follows?
No, I've heard about this.
Basically, it's about a girl has, you know, sex for the very first time, and this boy tells her, like, hey, guess what? I gave you this, not STD, but a curse.
This thing, it's going to follow you. Somebody gave it to me. And I passed it to you, back in the car. It could look like someone you know, or it could be a stranger in a crowd. Whatever helps it get close to you.
So it's kind of a modern horror movie and kind of a metaphor for a lot of the stuff that women are told about sexuality, pregnancy, and STDs, and AIDS, and everything else. And this, you know, poor girl just, you know, was in love, and suddenly, you know, it all goes downhill very, very quickly.
And then I noticed that you like Alien.
Alien is one of the scariest movies of all time.
It is absolutely the scariest.
Now, I think there's definitely an argument to say that the later films, like Aliens and Alien 3 and Alien 4, those are more action movies. But I think the original Alien is completely terrifying. But if you want to do something kind of older and more classic there, and things that, you know, aren't quite as scary but still give you this general sense of things, look at, like, Dracula's Daughter. It's the 1936 sequel to Dracula. Did you even know Dracula had a sequel?
No.
Me neither. So it stars Gloria Holden, who's beautiful and glamorous, and she plays Countess Maria Zaleska. And she kind of has to bear this burden of being her father's daughter and carrying on his legacy.
I'm sure we'd all be interested to know what modern science has to say about vampires. Go on, Jeffrey.
But surely you don't believe that preposterous rot, old fellow, what?
No, but I believe in Van Helsing.
It also may be one of the first movies to kind of start the cinematic meme of the lesbian vampire because she does express an interest in women, which was pretty racy for the time. But, you know, if you're a vampire, you could get away with a lot more than other people in 1936.
Okay, Melissa Locker, culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hello, Hal, do you read me?
Oh, my.
Dr. Peating, we're not in Kansas anymore.
We're not hosting an intergalactic kegger down here.
What the hell's wrong with freedom, man? That's what it's all about.
Why do you think I'm calling you? Just to say hello?
I gotta tell you, we did suicide missions in the Army that had better odds than this.
We're Never in Kansas on Friday when we talk about the weekend's movie releases with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Rafer, welcome.
Hi, John.
So what do we got? Two movies on this Friday. Inferno. Is Da Vinci Code actually a franchise?
It certainly is. This is the third one, right? Don't you remember Angels and Demons?
Yes, I do remember it. But, I mean, Ron Howard may think it's a franchise, but does box office say it's a franchise?
Yeah, we'll find out. But, you know, you've got Tom Hanks coming back as Robert Langdon, the symbologist, world-renowned symbologist, and this time he's involved in a mystery that involves Dante's Inferno.
If it's a viral agent, will it be released if I open it?
No. No, there'd be an inner sleeve, maybe even two.
Before I put myself in anyone's hands, I want to know what this thing is. And what I'm involved with. That makes sense, doesn't it?
Yes.
So, we agree. We're opening it.
Of course we're opening it, otherwise there'd be no movie.
It makes sense, doesn't it, John?
Yeah.
It's about the only thing that does make sense in this film. You know, the Da Vinci Code movies, at least the first one in the book, I always thought were kind of good, dumb fun that sort of made you feel smarter because they taught you a little bit about art history and medieval history and stuff.
The name of the rose coloring book, I suppose.
Exactly,
yeah, right.
That's exactly what it is. This one, we've dispensed with all that. There's no more Catholic Church hokum. It's just a good old-fashioned...
Dante is not Catholic Church official.
Well, you know, it's a pretty superficial, dot to dot they've drawn here between Dante and this virus that some guy wants to release to cull the world's population. So you've got this kind of empirical old doomsday plot that we're used to, and now you've got to travel through Europe and go to the Palazzo Vecchio and try to find out some clue that will lead you to the next place. And it's fun and it's fast paced and it's pretty dumb, but I think as slick entertainment, it works okay. Felicity Jones is in it. She's very good. Irfan Khan, the great Indian actor, has got a great role in this. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's – you check your brain at the door and it's all right.
So that means there will be a fourth, and at that point they just go directly to The Pope is a Robot.
That could very well be Pope as Terminator.
Number two here, American Pastoral. This is a movie of a perhaps unlikely Philip Roth novel. Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, the novel was Philip Roth's attempt, I think, to answer the great burning question of the 1960s, which was, what happened to the kids? Why did the kids go crazy? You know, you had an entire generation that worked very hard to give their children everything, and they turned against it. This stars Ewan McGregor making his directorial debut. He plays a guy whose daughter becomes a political terrorist.
And a great cast, Jennifer Connelly and Dakota Fanning.
Look, they gave me this award. It's just a stupid plaque, but it means one thing. If you take a stand, people notice. If you oppose the war, right here, with all your strength, this is part of America too, you know.
Read Marx. Revolutions don't begin in the countryside.
We're not talking about revolution.
You're not talking about revolution.
I can't quite figure this out. Is this Ian McGregor's Henry V for the 60s generation?
No, not quite. I think what he's done here is he's made a very good, solid drama about a father who has lost her daughter to some kind of revolutionary fever, maybe a cult, maybe some kind of movement. He's not sure. She commits this atrocious act that kills one of their neighbors, and he can't let her go. He can't turn his back on her. So you have this very nice father-daughter film that illuminates that relationship very well. But I mean, the thing about American Pastoral, it was about this country and what happened, what that generation rejected and in some ways destroyed. And I just don't think that Ewan McGregor is the right guy to pull that out and to give us that real context of the film. So it doesn't really feel like you understand what happened to this country in this movie.
He doesn't get it wrong. He just doesn't get it right.
I think he just, you know, I don't know if it's because he's Scottish or what it is. I think this book clearly meant something to him, but you just don't get that sense. You know, Philip Roth had such detail and richness in that book. That's not here in this film.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend, Rafer.
Thanks, John. You too.
Are you going to need a translator to understand the frenzied fans at Wrigley Field on this historic day in baseball, where everyone you hear is going to talk like this?
We are coming to you live from Ditka's here on Thanksgiving Day, a day for giving thanks for, or taking punishment from, a team that is known as the Bears.
The Bears.
We'll leave the baseball to the sports fans. It's the linguistics of Chicagoese we want to think about as the first World Series game since 1945, Game 3 against the Cleveland Indians is played tonight at Wrigley Field.
Well, a lot of things happened today, and they were all great, and they were all thrilling, and they were all dramatic. Too bad we couldn't have had a victory that meant a pennant, but that will come. Sure as God made green apples, someday the Chicago Cubs are going to be in the World Series.
That's the late legendary Chicago Cubs announcer Harry Carey at the end of the 1991 baseball season. The day's come for the Cubs, and born and bred Chicagoan Dennis Foley says the Cubs may have waited too long to get back in the series. Chicagoese is not the first language of the Windy City that it once was. Foley chronicles the changing Chicago accent with his book, We Speak Chicagoese. He joins me now. Dennis, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's good to be with you, John.
You know, let's just ask right up front. I mean, of the Ron Burgundies and the Anchorman of the world turn Midwest speak into, you know, the diluter of Chicagoese?
You know what? I got to tell you, John, that in my opinion, Chicagoese, you know, that Chicago accent, it's definitely alive and well.
The Cubs haven't outlived its, I mean, it's been waiting for so long to have the Cubs at Wrigley Field in the series.
Oh, and I, you know what? Back in 1969, I was a 9-year-old kid, and I cried my eyes out when the Cubs fell apart in the September sun and went down to the Mets. But it's going to be different. We're going to roll things, keep moving forward against the Indians.
Where did it come from? I mean, and say you say Chicago, right? Is that it?
You know, you get people that say Chicago, Chicago. I'm a Chicago guy. It's right. Like sausage, but definitely Chicago for me.
Do millennials go in for this?
So the millennials, not so much, but so yes, it is being watered down, but you're always going to have those people, like I said, that, you know, kind of like our blue collar guys. And, you know, I was one too. I worked as an electrician in streets and sand. And, you know, you want to talk about running around all day and hearing guys, hey, Tony, go ahead and give me two, three of those bundles of pipe over there and throw it in the side. We got to get that stuff moving. You know, it's never going to die. You have these people that are, you know, rooted in that speech, and it's always going to be here.
So what's the beer chant at Wrigley if you're selling brewskis?
You know what? I the chant I like more is just our, you know, throw it back chant after someone hits a homer and hopefully on the other team. And hopefully we don't get too many of those tonight.
If you're wanting to get a brew at Wrigley, you say, get your beer here, something like that.
Yeah, the vendor walking around is, you know, hey, beer here.
Right,
you know, definitely
right.
Giving us that little bite. And, you know, it's going to be a fun one to watch him play here later.
And how does the dog salesman sound?
Yeah, same kind of thing, too. You know, red hot, dogs, and they're just barking and walking up and down the aisles. So,
Dennis, are you a South Sider?
Definitely. South Side. I moved a total of 9 different times when I was a kid from neighborhood to neighborhood, but always within different parts of the city of Chicago and on the South Side.
But if you're a South Sider, I mean, you got to have a little problem with the Cubbies here.
Hey, I know where you're going.
Yeah,
there, but
I went to school on the South Side.
Yeah, okay. You know what? And you know it too. But I'm proud to stand on my South Side roots. But the fact of the matter is, I am a South Side Cub fan. My grandfather came over from Ireland. And when he came over, he was on the north side for a short bit of time before he became a man of wisdom and moved to the south side. And he brought his love of the Cubs with him. And that's been since 1922 that the Foley family have been Cub fans.
Has anybody ever said, you know, maybe you need to lose that accent to, you know, advance your professional career?
No. I mean, and I think people from other places, you know, might find the accent kind of interesting. And it's kind of funny because I, you know, when I talk to people, I don't really think I have much of an accent, though I know there's something there. But it's not as layered as I, you know, some of those guys that really kind of get deep into the Chicagoese.
A little sniffle for Harry Carey, who must be up there watching.
Yeah, and you know what, Harry Carey, and then, you know, my favorite guy as a kid growing up too, Ernie Banks, you know, just, you know, the way he played the game, you see, you know, guys like him, and then you got Ron Santo. I think we got a lot of fellas up there that are, you know, definitely throwing the thumbs up for the Cubs to bring it home against the Indians.
For the Cubs. A lot of happy ghosts haunting Wrigley Field tonight, that's right.
I think that goat has been slaughtered, John.
I said ghosts, not goat.
Oh, yeah. Oh, see, I thought you were throwing a little bit of a goat there.
No, I'm trying to be nice. Dennis, thanks so much.
And once again, I enjoyed being on. Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Chicago accent disappearing. We asked you, what's your regional accent and how's it doing?
Hi, I'm Katie Lister. I live in Wichita Falls, Texas.
Hi, this is Larry Fisher from Brooklyn, New York. Brooklyn, New York.
Aloha, Michelle from Honolulu.
Hi, I grew up in Springfield, Massachusetts, live in New York now.
I am from Kansas originally, and I have not fully picked up a Texas accent. The Texans here think I sound northern, and the people in Kansas think I sound Texan.
I have a friend who gives me a call, and he says, hey, Larry, can you use 10 cases of Earl? I got 10 cases of Earl for you. And I'm like, Earl? Earl? What's Earl? Earl! You cook with it!
Yeah, we used to hear a lot more pidgin here, but not so much nowadays. Things like, eh, like grind. Keren, we go. Translation, hey, want to go eat? Okay then, we're going.
My accent is minimal, but I still do talk about drinking water from bubblers, eating Chinese food, and going around Rotary.
Christopher from New York City. Being raised in New Jersey, there was always the temptation to fall into the Jersey accent. I fought that in college and in high school on a school radio program where I became an announcer.
And this is what I think sounds like an accentless accent from Texas, but it may sound more southern than I think it does.
To answer your question, is my regional dialect or accent disappearing? I guess the answer would be, nope, I still park my car the same way.
Call 877-8-MY-TAKE with your best accent to have it saved for posterity. I think we're feeling over this election, right? Can we vote already? I mean, what a way to take all the magic out of a possible first woman president. And maybe she won't win. Have to say that, right? And we must note that Hillary Clinton stands on the shoulders of Shirley Chisholm and 12 other women who have run for president of the United States. There was Victoria Woodhull. First of all, after moving from rural Ohio to New York, Woodhull announced her candidacy for president in a letter to the editor of the New York Herald in April of 1870, 50 years before women even gained the right to vote. Let's say she wasn't a centrist, a proponent of women's rights, labor reforms, and free love. Woodhull's campaign faced a chilly reception. Critics responded by calling her Mrs. Satan. And a feud with prominent Protestant minister Henry Ward Beecher, whom she accused of adultery to highlight sexual double standards of the time, landed her in jail just days before the election. The Woodhull story has opera written all over it, and conductor and composer Victoria Bond decided to create one. That's soprano Cheryl Hickman as Victoria Woodhull announcing her intention to run for president in Victoria Bond's Mrs. President. It's kind of a Joan of Arc story in the Big Apple without any burning stakes. Victoria Bond says the Woodhull stories got everything.
Well, she was a spiritualist, and she heard the voice of Demosthenes tell her to go to New York, meet Cornelius Vanderbilt, and find her way towards, I don't know if Demosthenes said the presidency. I wasn't there. But at any rate, it was word to go. And she did. She and her sister met Cornelius Vanderbilt. They set her up on Wall Street, and she made a lot of money. And that's what fueled her campaign.
As a stock trader.
Yes. And then she also started her own newspaper. They were the first to print the Communist Manifesto, so it was obviously a very liberal rag. And Frederick Douglass was her running mate. So in 1872, she declared herself candidate for president. And she,
and the idea that Frederick Douglass would be her running mate gives an enormous amount of credibility to this race. I mean, Frederick Douglass was no slouch. I mean, he was a towering, you know, historical figure at the time. And so Victoria was onto something here.
Absolutely. And of course, neither of them could had the vote.
Right.
But, you know, what a bold move. You know, she knew, I believe she knew that she would never become president. But it gave her basically a platform on which to say her ideas about women's equality. At first, she was embraced by the suffragists because the right to vote was certainly part of that. But she went so far beyond that. She really wanted equal rights for women. And, of course, there were certain inflammatory words in her campaign for which the suffragists totally distanced themselves, the words free love, mm-hmm. which could easily be misconstrued and was misconstrued then as it would be now. But at the time, women had no independent rights. Even though they could divorce their husbands, they would not have the right to the children or the property, and they would be basically a pariah in society. So she called those kind of loveless relationships legalized prostitution, which, as you can imagine, is pretty inflammatory in itself.
So quite a platform, and certainly an arduous journey to possibly even make it to the White House, which she knew was unattainable. Does such an impossible journey make for a great opera or a great show?
Well, it does in that she got as far as she did to have an audience and to attract the attention of Henry Ward Beecher, who himself was, as you say, one of the most powerful people of his day. And the end of the opera really is, in a way, what the whole opera is about. She is in jail, having been jailed on election night. She is probably at the lowest point in her life. Her friends have abandoned her. Her husband has left her. Her financial empire is in complete ruin, something that would have felled even the most powerful person. And here she is. She says, I may not get there, but other people will come after me. They will pick up these ideas and they will carry them further. So here is somebody who had a vision that went beyond herself. And I find that in itself to be extremely inspiring and worthy of an opera.
What do audiences say about this show?
Oh, I've had very wonderful responses. I think that what music can bring to a story like this is the emotional underpinning. And even though the words are extremely important and they give you the context, it's really the music that carries the emotional punch of each of these characters.
And the show viscerally takes gender differences as a real theme of what her candidacy was about and the names that she was called and the success that she wanted and was denied her. And oddly, this campaign in 2016 is all about gender differences and the brutality of language used to describe them.
And isn't it interesting how it has brought so much misogyny in this country to the fore? We knew it was there and it was hiding in the shadows, but now it's right out there in the open.
Victoria Woodhull would recognize Donald Trump, I guess is what you're saying.
Absolutely. Well, Henry Ward Beecher had a lot of Donald Trump about him. He was a bully and he was used to getting his way and used to being able to overpower women. And I think when he comes up against Victoria Woodhull in a scene called Predators, where they meet for the first time, he assumes that he's going to be able to bludgeon her into submission. And she just says simply, I know what your private life is about. The story is ready to print.
You are high. You reap the pain.
all at once he sees that his entire religious empire could come crumbling down with an expose like that. And so that kind of brings him to his knees, just temporarily.
Where do we go after this election? So many milestones, it seems, have been kind of crossed.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's so many other countries that have had a woman in a leadership position. Certainly England has had, you know, as prime minister, and, you know, India, you look around the world, and this is not such a big deal. I mean, it's happened already. And so I think it's about time. I think we're long overdue to have a woman in the White House. And I think it will make a lot of difference. I think there's a certain kind of humanity that a woman brings and a perspective to this position that we have not seen before. And I am celebrating.
Victoria Bond, thanks so much for being with us.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Victoria Bond is a composer and conductor, currently principal guest conductor of Chamber Opera Chicago, Mrs. President, an opera in two acts with music by Victoria Bond and libretto by Hilary Bell, will be formed today in New York City's Opera Center. And now we can say it. We've all lived long enough to experience the pre-Vine era, the Vine era, and the post-Vine era, apparently. That extreme short-form video platform Vine will soon join Friendster, Grooveshark, and Gawker, wherever buzzy internet sites go to die. To commemorate 6-second video loops, we offer this 19 seconds of enjoyment or annoyance.
Hey, I'm sorry, I didn't see you there. I was too busy blocking out the haters.
I'm gonna get crunk. Abraz on fleek.
Do you have a favorite Vine? Tweet it to us. We're at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. I'm John Hockenberry. I'm John Hockenberry. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.